This is Hacker Public Radio episode 3138 for Wednesday, the 12th of August 2020. Today's show is entitled Linux In-Laws Season 1 Episode 12, Reminiscing in Floss Weekly, and is part of the series Linux In-Laws. It is hosted by Monochromec and is about 94 minutes long and carries an explicit flag. The summary is an interview with Randall Schwartz of Floss Weekly fame.
This episode of HPR is brought to you by Archive.org. Support universal access to all knowledge by heading over to archive.org/donate.
Is Linux In-Laws, a podcast on topics around free and open source software, any associated contraband, communism, the revolution in general, and whatever else fancies your tickle. Please note that this and other episodes may contain strong language, offensive humor, and other certainly not politically correct language. You have been warned. Our parents insisted on this disclaimer. Happy Mum! Thus, the content is not suitable for consumption in the workplace, especially when played back on a speaker in an open plan office or similar environments. Any minors under the age of 35, or any pets, including fluffy little killer bunnies, your trusted guide dog, unless on speed, and cute T-Rexes or other associated dinosaurs. This is Linux In-Laws, Season 1, Episode 12. Reminiscing on Floss Weekly. Martin, how are things?
Things are great.
Perfect.
Audio is working, no echoes, no automatic volume adjustment.
Finally!
What else could possibly go wrong?
Excellent. yes.
How are you?
Not too bad. Really looking forward to today's interview with a guy called Randall Schwartz. We have been working on this for quite some time, as probably most of our listeners know. Randall used to do a show called Floss Weekly for the last 10 years at least, I think. But Randall will tell us more during the upcoming interview. But before we get to that guest, let's do some news. What do you have in terms of news, as in things that are not old, unlike us?
Or grumpy.
Yes, Mark, why don't you tell us about the new and upcoming podcast?
Well, the young and joyful coders.
These are the ones.
These are the ones, indeed. Starring ourselves.
The
news, yes. My biggest news, I think, was the Mac announcement. Presumably you are familiar with this one.
Which one? There are quite a few these days.
Well, they probably are, being the size of the company they are, but obviously the change from Intel to ARM-based, making their own chips for Mac.
I thought we were recording this in July, not June, but maybe I'm wrong.
We're doing old news, so there we go.
Other news!
Four-week-old news.
Okay, I don't know if you heard this, but Google made an announcement last week. We are recording this. What's the date, Martin? 27th. Yes. Google made an announcement last week, actually, that they finally open up user level threads. Mm-hmm. As avid listeners of the show will recall, there was an episode not too long ago where an unbeknownst co-host
basically, I can't remember what episode it was, but just to recap, there are kernel level threads and there are user level threads. And the disadvantage of kernel level threads is that once you do a rescheduling of any thread, you have to cross from user to kernel space, do the rescheduling, as in the context switch, and go back to user space, which normally is a very cost-intensive time operation in terms of CPU cycles. So the idea behind something called futex, as in fast user space mutexes, is to minimize the amount of boundary crossings, as in to the kernel and back, so that the majority of the stuff can be done in user space. There were additions to the kernel as early as, I think, 2.5, and Google made a presentation of an enhancement of this API in 2013. Essentially, it's a fine-grained optimization to that user space API that allows simply a swapping of threads. Imagine your ordinary message queue. Say there's one thread producing stuff, then another thread is consuming, is modifying this, and the then the producing thread is takes the result back again. So in essence, you would have, from a kernel perspective, three context switches: one from thread one to two, and then back to thread one. So, needless to say, with a few texts, as they're called, you can do this with also three operations. But Google has proposed, as early as 2013, and you'll find the link in the show note, a mechanism basically to simply swap these threads, combining operation one and three. And you'll find the performance benchmarks in that presentation that we're going to link to. But if for this particular use case, it's quite significant. They have, according to the Linux kernel mailing list, they have proposed this as of last week, but when I did some research for this episode, I came up about a Fuchsia article that is as old as last year, I think. So apparently the Fuchsia implementation is ahead of the Linux kernel patches that they have just submitted for 5.9.
Okay, so it's actually been submitted already. Cool.
It's coming up for 5.9, and I reckon this is only the first set of patches that they will do for their full implementation of a full-blown user space threat library. With the idea is, of course, to make this much more performant. Apparently, they have been using this kernel or these user-level threads actually for the last couple of years inside Google. But they are only slowly open sourcing this, and this is the first kind of patch set, because it's only one, that we're seeing right now.
Okay. Looks like they are finally embracing.
Oh, they have been doing this from day one, more or less. But they haven't open sourced it. It's, of course, the secret sauce in terms of the search engine algorithm, but stuff like Protobuf or something called gRPC built on top of Protobuf have always been open source. Go, Lang is open source. Kubernetes is, just to name a few contributions to the community. In contrast to what other people say, Google has always been a strong proponent of open source. It's just the case that they do not open source everything, but rather only selected components.
Like many companies.
Yes, do. More or less.
Cleaning our own.
Yeah, full disclosure, if people haven't listened to the back episodes, we work for Redis Labs. Yes, an open core company. I will continue to work there, whereas that's unfortunately not the case with Martin anymore. I can spill the beans, right?
Yeah, spill the beans.
Martin is actually is joining a company called Microsoft, probably known for its closed source approach for the last 30 or 40 years, and I think he won't be joining the WSL team. That's for sure.
No.
He won't. No.
Sorry. No. Let's not do that.
No.
So what about your future employer?
It's still a company called Redis Labs that hasn't changed.
Okay. Not the Rust Academy.
No. And I'm not. I do not intend to start a Rust Academy. No. Okay. Maybe now it's time to bring on our special guest. Yes. So, with no further ado, let's get into the interview. Randall Schwartz, Mr. Randall Schwartz, great to have you with us. First of all, thank you very much for taking the time. This is somewhat of a free flow format. So in contrast to Floss Weekly, we don't have any script, no questions. I'm joking. We don't have any prepared list of questions. So what we would like to do basically, shed some more light on you as a person. And of course, Floss Weekly probably being the most important open source podcast on the planet. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about the history of this and your contribution in this era, which has been, of course, given the last 10 years, be more than significant. But let's start off with Randall Schwartz as a private person, not having invented Perl, but certainly having contributed a lot of knowledge to the community. So why don't you give us a little bit of a background about you and where you come from?
Okay, well, I've been doing open source for, I think, 20 years now. Well, no, at least as long as Perl's been around, so I guess about 30 years. I'm trying to figure out, I'm going to do the math here. It's I'm getting old, so math is tough. You know, it's kind of crazy that way. I got into Perl because I had been contributing to the mailing list for Perl, but back before there was actually a Usenet news group. And at one point, Larry came out with Larry Wall, creator of Perl, came out with version. I think it was 3, and the man page had gone from 20 pages to 60 pages, and people said, there's too much documentation. Can you write up some sort of tutorial or something? And I had been a technical writer for probably 15 years before that. So, in fact, I have somewhere, actually it's in storage right now, but somewhere I have a shelf full of books that I wrote, but I ghost wrote it because, you know, I was working for various companies and basically writing for them as a hired contractor. And I think at that point I was an employee at most places. So I've only been a contractor for since, I don't know, it's been a while. It's definitely been a while. So Larry said in response to that, where I said there's too much documentation. What they really wanted was tutorial stuff, and I was really good at writing up that sort of thing. And so Larry said, "Well, if I get some spare time, I'll write something up." And I knew that Larry had, you know, a wife and 4 kids, and he was a church choir director, and he had a day job and all this stuff. So I knew that him getting spare time was going to be a bit dicey, probably not going to happen anytime soon. So I volunteered. I said, you know, if Larry wants to write something up, I'd be happy to help him with it. And the sysadmin at O'Reilly, Amber, I think it was her name, said, well, if you're going to write something up, we might as well publish it. So I never pitched Programming Perl. I never pitched it anywhere. It just it basically got solicited by O'Reilly. And so I immediately wrote Larry, and I said, Larry, they want us to write a book. I'll go in with you on it, which is an awkward preposition, a proposal. I don't know if you remember the movie Xanadu. Maybe you didn't see that, but you're probably more sane for not having seen it six or seven times.
This is one of your favorites, right?
But one of the things they said in the movie, which I really like, which was, what's a partnership like? And it's like marriage without the good parts. And it's one funny. Of my favorite lines.
That's
and
so a good quote.
Yeah. So I knew that if I was gonna, you know, I knew that this book would take about, you know, I don't know, 10 months to a year to write, and we'd have to do it all by, and back then it was just email. There was no IRC, there was no we didn't really have FTP. You know, so it was all sending chapters back and forth by email. And so, but I got involved by writing Programming Perl. And then I started teaching classes in the Silicon Valley. And I had to prepare tutorial materials for that class, obviously, because, you know, the Programming Perl is not a tutorial book. And about midway through the first week, somebody came up to me and said, you know, Programming Perl is a good book. We like it. But this set of materials you've got here is much better. It should be a book. And so I emailed Tim O'Reilly. Back then, he made a lot of the decisions. I think he still makes some decisions, but I don't know. I think he's probably mostly kind of out of the loop now. But I said, here's the chapter titles. You know, this, I think this would be a good book because it would be a tutorial book that would be nice. And the fastest response I ever got from him was 15 minutes later. He wrote back and said immediately, let's do it. Let's do it. Because Programming Perl was gold. It was amazing. You know, it set outpaced all the records. They normally print enough copies on their first run to theoretically last a year. We sold that out in a month. So it was an amazing, like, over the top for sales and stuff like that. Well, Learning Perl became the basis of my income for the next 6 or 7 years, because I had 5 instructors working for me. I was traveling all over the U.S. Teaching classes personally, but also having my other instructors teach classes at various places. And it put me on the map. You know, I kind of missed those days because I was making money hand over fist, you know, and now it's not so much. So, I'm back to just, you know, being a contractor for hire. So, not quite the same. So, my contributions to Perl were primarily, me contributing on the net, you know, talking to people, and also these books. I wasn't involved after Programming Perl second edition, or yeah, after that. So, you know, I still get royalties from Learning Perl. So that's kind of nice. And also Intermediate Perl. And I don't think I get anything off Mastering Perl because it's not really my book. It's that's Brian Foy's book. So, okay. that's kind of the back and forth. You know, I help people on the net. And I wrote these wonderful books.
So I take it then from what you were saying about the kind of the you were initially really busy and getting a nice income from this writing these books that in current days Perl is less popular. Let's put it that way.
No, it's actually still more popular. It's a smaller piece of a bigger
pie. People don't write books anymore.
That's the problem. Yeah, that's the problem. It's a smaller piece of a bigger pie. But there's actually more Perl coding being done today than there was during the .com boom. So it's still very popular. It's just, it doesn't seem like it because, again, it's a smaller piece of a bigger pie.
But you see this with daily rates because Perl programmers and admins in that area are still in high demand, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. In fact, the big problem, the big problem we have right now in the Perl community is that managers want to hire Perl people, but they can't find enough of them. You know, people are going, oh, I want to be on Python. I want to be on Ruby. I want to be on all these other things. And they're moving away from Perl, but if they could make a ton of money if they just, you know, and Perl's not that hard to learn. You know, it's still pretty easy.
But then you see, even if these young hipsters become involved with Dart, like a certain Randall L. Schwartz.
Yeah.
Given the fact that you are some sort of ambassador for Google here?
Yes, I'm at least at the moment.
GKE or something, right? Yeah.
GDE. At least at the moment. It turns out I'm supposed to be recording all the things I'm doing for Flutter and Dart. And I haven't been, and so they're probably going to cut me at the end of the year. So, which would be sad. But you know, the problem is that their form doesn't allow for the things that I'm typically doing. Typically, what I'm doing is I'm on Gitter, I'm on Stack Overflow, I'm on IRC. You know, and those are things that can't get recorded. They want actual. Like, I did this presentation at this conference. Well, I'm not going to conferences. I'm not doing that. So I'm probably, this is probably my last year as a Flutter GDE, but I shouldn't say that out loud because it might give them ideas.
Okay.
Yeah. But no, what that represents is that I got vetted 2 years ago. I think it was 2 years ago. And, basically got asked a lot of questions from a lot of experts. And what's funny is I went to a meeting for Google, for the Google GDEs, and some guys sat next to me and said, thank you for everything you're doing in Gitter and Stack Overflow and all that stuff. We really, really, really appreciate that. But that, I don't think that's enough to actually carry me through the next vetting process, so we'll see. I don't know. It's okay.
It'd can be you nice. Talk? Yeah. Can you talk about this vetting process, or would that be under NDA?
It's the simplified version of it is that I got asked a bunch of questions, and here's the funny part. I did a sort of a end run to begin with, where I said, "Look, I'm still learning Dart and Flutter, but I know how to Google."
And so
they went, well, then you don't need to. And so what's funny is the entire technical interview, it should be a technical interview, I didn't get asked a single Dart or Flutter question.
You serious?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, that was pretty funny. But also because I carried in a reputation too. I was, you know, I was well known, you know, Floss Weekly, things like that. And so they wanted my energy and charisma and were willing to sort of ignore the fact that I'm still learning Flutter and Dart.
Okay.
Yeah.
Going back to Perl now, what do you make of Perl 6 and Chameleon and all the rest of it? Given the fact that this is quite a diversion from Perl 5 and the community, as far as I perceive, is quite split up about the issue.
I don't see any reason for me to learn it because I don't think there's a business investment for me.
Okay,
you know, and I have to focus on things that, you know, I'm going to get business out of, and I'm going to get a lot more business out of Flutter and Dart than I am out of Perl 6. for sure.
Do you think that this is, I mean, some people are under the impression that this is actually a stillborn, given the diversion from Perl 5 and hipster concepts like a virtual machine that is used for Perl 6, and never mind the incompatibility to the old code base?
There is a big Perl 6, well, Rokudo now, or whatever it's called now. They changed the name.
I think it's either Camellia or Rokudo or something like this. I know what you mean. The VM, yes. The underlying VM infrastructure.
I don't know why you keep saying VM. Well, it's like
it's a virtual machine.
Layers. That all changed. That all changed about 2 years ago.
I'm out of touch, apparently. Please elaborate.
Yeah. So basically, what happens is as Perl 6, as Rokudo boots, it builds new layers all the way up.
Okay.
And so, but those are all written, all pretty much written in Perl, but various kinds of Perl. There's mini Perl and medium Perl. I don't know all the names, but
large Perl.
Large Perl, right.
Okay.
So the lowest level is actually generated from Perl code. So they have a Perl to machine code, well, not machine code, a Perl to C translator at the lowest level. And so it's actually Perl all the way down now.
Great, I see.
Which is really interesting, yeah.
So this is self-hosted. And how does the Perl to C layer work? Because I reckon you can't do it with on the fly compilation, right?
I don't know what you mean by
if you take Perl 6 source code and translate this to C and then translate it to machine code every time you start up such environment, that will take a lot of time.
No, a lot of that's cached. So.
Ah, okay.
So, they're sort of the lowest levels of boot, and then those are cached so that they can be used again the next time. This is my understanding. I'm probably wrong, and I'm probably going to get yelled at by my Rokudo friends. But like I said, I'm not studying it. I think Dart and Flutter have better legs than Perl 6 does for any use.
Well, given the fact that we're looking at an established ecosystem available on most of the platforms, including desktop, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of which, what do you make of WebASM and the Rust community around this, if you can speak about this or want to?
Haven't been tracking that, actually.
Okay. But you know what I'm talking about, right?
Oh, of course. Yeah, of course. I know about Rust. I know about WebASM. But at some point that may be targeted by the Flutter community, but the Dart community, because that would make sense. At some point it might be targeted, but there's not enough motivation because they've got Dart to JS fast enough that it's almost the same as if you had WebASM, so.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, given the fact that quite a few members of the community are actively working on a Rust to WebASM compiler, meaning that the LLVM backend, the underlying compiler infrastructure behind Rust can then generate WebASM instructions. That gives you a whole new perspective about clients and about client-side web frameworks.
Yep.
And I reckon Rust, I wouldn't say it's the most prominent one, but it certainly has a lot of exposure in this area. And I don't see Dart quite there yet, if Dart is targeting this at all, which is a very up-and-coming sector, by the way.
Dart is Dart to JS is very mature, and I mean it's being used in huge projects at Google and other places now. The reason you don't hear about it is because people got upset when Dart wasn't going to be embedded in the browsers.
Okay.
It was communicated wrongly. It should have been communicated in the way that this will mean that we don't need to put it in all the browsers. You know, we've got a very efficient Dart to JS. And in fact, the current one is really great. It's got incremental compilation, incremental load, nice debugging, all sorts of things that you would want out of any kind of native VM. And part of the problem is that they were coming up with conflicts about who's on first when you had both the Dart VM and the V8 VM both fighting over who's got control.
Indeed. I mean, V8 is a pretty efficient implementation. I mean, Google perfected this pretty much down to the notch.
Right, which means that once you have a good Dart to JS, you just spit it at the V8, yeah. And you're done.
I mean, but on the other side, I mean, if you're targeting a whole suite like G Suite at the client, you probably need a very efficient JavaScript implementation, because otherwise this commercial model will fold, because the browser is simply not fast enough to execute this properly. So you need a good JavaScript implementation.
Right.
Changing tack now.
How did you get involved in the Dart Flutter?
Excellent question, Martin.
Scene, let's put it that way.
Well, I had heard about Dart, and I ended up having a couple of Dart people on Floss Weekly, and I got excited about that. And then it turns out that, when Flutter was first coming out, my buddy Wim Leeler he's a local Portlander, so Portland, Oregon, by the way. You don't know which Portland I'm talking about. And it turns out that he was working for Google, and he had come on. He had invited me to come look at the Google offices in downtown Portland, and I said sure. So I came on to the property, and so he started talking about Flutter and all that stuff, and I said, well, I want to write a Dart book. And he goes, no, I don't think you want to write a Dart book. I think you want to write a Flutter book. And I said, why? And he goes, well, here's what's interesting about Flutter. And it's, you know, the hot reload, the multi-platform. But, you know, being cross-platform between iOS and Android wasn't really the big selling point, he said. In fact, when we did a presentation together, and at the last bullet below all the other bullets was also works on both iOS and Android. And it's because that's not the important thing. If you were just doing iOS or just doing Android, you should still be using Flutter. It's so much easier to code, and you don't have to know all the native APIs. You don't have to deal with all that. It's just a much better ecosystem.
Okay.
Yeah.
Then how do you rate the maturity of this now? It's obviously been around for a few years, but
there's like thousands of applications in both stores already. So, yes, I think it's mature. And the fact that it's now working Flutter on web, Flutter on desktop. There's a few more platforms that are coming along, but I can't say because I'm under an NDA. But, that's part of what I have to remember, is that I'm under an NDA, so I have to be careful about what I say in public.
Sorry, Chris. You mentioned that.
Sorry, go ahead there.
There's a great demand for Perl developers. What's that like for the Flutter and Dart kind of?
Well, people? most of the stuff is green starts. So people are forking off of their own companies, I should say, and are building it themselves. But you don't really need to be a Flutter expert. If you have some mobile experience, you can pick up Flutter really quick. And Dart's actually a pretty simple language to learn as well. And it's really strongly typed now. It was only like loosely typed before. But Dart 2.0 is very strongly typed. It's so much that I'm still trying to figure out how to do everything. It's a little confusing for me, having come from the Perl world, you know, so complicated stuff.
Changing. Sorry, go ahead, Mark.
Yeah, no, carry on, carry on.
You mentioned one important word there, Floss Weekly. Given the full disclosure, Floss Weekly probably was one of my most influential podcasts that I've been listening to for the last almost 10 years. Again, full disclosure, it has shaped my view on open source to a big extent and also got me involved with the community in terms of contributing to my own local Linux user group here in Frankfurt, where I live, getting involved with the community, organizing conference and all the rest of it. Can you tell us a little bit about how you got involved with Floss Weekly and how this whole Twit/Leo thing started off?
Yeah, so I don't exactly know how Twit started, but there was some sort of This Week in Tech, I guess, was the first podcast that they did. So what happened was I was a guest on episode 9, and after 17 episodes, Chris DeBona, who was sort of shepherding, essentially doing my role that I had for many years after that, he had a baby. Well, his wife had
himself
a baby.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so I was doing a show. I was invited by Leo to go up to Vancouver, BC, and be a guest on a few shows up there. That was a video show, a TV show, actually. And during one of the breaks, I said, what happened to Floss Weekly? And he said, well, you know, Chris DeBona, he got busy. Chris DeBona, by the way, in case you don't know, is like the open source advocate at Google. So he has an important responsibility, and, you know, it got a little busy for him. And I said, so what would it take to get that restarted? And he goes, well, I need to get guests. You know, I need to get guests and like that. I said, well, if I bring you guests, can I like, you know, help out? Can I co-host and stuff? And he goes, sure. And so my first guest didn't come along for another couple months. Then the next one was like a couple months. So it wasn't really weekly for a while, but I started getting a little more regular and started doing that. And so I was pretty much the primary co-host for all those shows for the first maybe 30 shows, 40 shows, somewhere in there.
That was 2010 or something?
I don't know. Let me do the math.
Don't worry about it.
20, yeah, well, it was 13 years before 2020, so that's the 2007.
Okay, yes.
Yeah. Right. So occasionally I couldn't make it. So we had like John O'Bacon on and a few others.
John O'Bacon. Sort of filled in.
Yeah. He was a co-host for a couple of shows. Yeah. Which was really nice. So at some point Leo just emails me and says, just take the show over. I mean, you know what you're doing. You know how to get the guests on, and you can probably be a pretty good co-host and stuff like that. So that was about a year after we started with the new format. And then I've been showrunner ever since then, until about a month ago.
So the idea of a rotating roster of co-hosts, was that your idea? Like the ones of, like Aaron, like Dan, like yeah. Simon, all the rest of them.
Well, I mean, people aren't always available. I was willing to put in the time to always carve out whatever I needed, except when I was on a cruise ship or whatever. So I was pretty consistent, but you know, other people not so consistent. So I had to have a rotating panel of co-hosts. Could make it work.
All the production and everything around your show yourself, or did you have some help with that?
Oh, so I had everything up to the end of the show.
Okay.
So in other words, I had to work out who was the guest, who was the co-host, what was the subjects, you know, organize all that. That was all mine. And that was about 5 hours a week, maybe four or five, somewhere in there. And that includes the taping time, because the taping time cuts into that. And then the moment it's in the can, the moment we finish the show, Twit does the rest. So they would do the editing down, which wasn't much because we pretty much did live to tape. So there wasn't much to do. And then they would do the website, and they would do the CDN upload and all that stuff. So. Yeah, so I was lucky because I got all the fun parts.
Well, yeah, not fun. Not fun. I guess with building the momentum, it was presumably easier to get guests later on, like that.
Oh right, we got to the point. We got to the point. Well, let me follow up on that note first, and then we'll talk about the spreadsheet. We got to the point where PR people were emailing me saying, my client needs to be on your show. And I knew at that point I had made it.
Mm.
Because if I was visible enough that the PR people were like emailing me, you know, then I was solid. Definitely solid. Yeah. So
you didn't consider charging them for this, did you?
Sorry, what?
You didn't consider charging them to come on your show yet, so.
No, I would feel bad. You know, people have always said, well, why don't you have like a Patreon or something like that? And I said, no, I mean, the whole point of this is that Twit needs to get the recognition for, you know, their advertising revenue and all that stuff. I don't want to cut into that because, there's a lot of production costs involved on the back end. You know, all the editing, and I mean, you guys know. You know, there's a lot of stuff to do.
Absolutely.
So there's no way I was going to cut into that.
I can only recall a very few instances where actually people misused this as a marketing vehicle. The most prominent one, probably the one where Simon simply flipped. If you remember this.
Oh, he flips a lot, though.
but really bad. You remember this open source consultancy thing, and Simon was all over it.
Okay. Yeah. Well, you know, it's all a blur to me now. I don't remember anything about the show.
No worries. The feedback that I got from other people I talked to about this episode was quite riveting in terms of Simon lost it. Let's put it this way, because he really took the guy apart. I must look it up because I can't remember the exact episode, but okay. The guy took it quite cool. It was an open source consultancy company that used closed source software internally to do the assessments.
Oh, I think I remember that one, but it's only vague now. Like I said,
don't worry about it.
It's all a blur. All a blur.
Yeah, it's that episode where Simon lost it.
Yes.
show notes at some point.
You know what's funny is I don't remember really any of the episodes. And part of it is that, you know, somebody will say, well, can you put these guys on the show, and I go, this sounds vaguely familiar, and I have to Google a Floss Weekly and a topic okay. in order now, to figure out if I've done a show or not.
Now, tell us about the spreadsheet then.
Well, the spreadsheet was my way of organizing. So we had the public side of it, which is what you could see from the public link. But there's three additional columns on the right-hand side of the spreadsheet that were private only. And that's how we would organize, you know, what ads there are, who's available for a co-host, you know, all that stuff, the email address of the contact, things like that. So that was all in one place. So it was really, really easy for me to manage the show. You know, so although you only saw the first two columns, I had all these other columns behind it that actually were the detailed information about that particular show.
An interesting thing, because every now and then I used to look at the spreadsheet and notice the names coming up there. And right. fair play to you, Randall. There were quite a few Linux projects on that list. For example, you intended to interview Leonard Pöttering of SystemD fame, right. According at least to the spreadsheet, but it never came to that because you never had him on the show, right?
Well, you know, so I would open up like another month or two of shows, and I have all the stuff that's just right at the top of the beginning of the bottom half, and I would email them like month by month. So there was a ton of email I sent out all the time, and you know, people didn't respond. I couldn't make them respond.
Fair enough. So,
yeah. So you know, it was a little tricky. So that was my most frustrating part, is that people who had said, I want to be on the show, and then I email them, you know, every other month or so, and they never respond. So it's like, what's the deal here? So yeah, that was one of the frustrating parts of managing the show.
Okay. The next question is probably a little bit tricky, but for avid listeners of Floss Weekly, the following question might not be a surprise, because at some stage, Doc Searls took over of Linux Magazine fame, but also of Twitter fame, need to say. It sounded from the outside a little bit abrupt, that change. So, given the fact that there was no communication on the Twitter website, I'm just wondering what happened.
No, there is communication on the website. Okay. There's a whole article on the transition and that Doc's taken over and that we thank Randall for 13 years of valuable service. No, okay. there's a page on their it was on their blog, I think, somewhere in there. But yeah, no.
This is probably it probably shows that I'm pretty old myself, so maybe I've just have missed this. But no, it just sounded like a little bit strange from the outset. But maybe I should reread this blog.
Yeah. I think it's linked from a Twitter a tweet.
This is the problem, Randall. I'm just too old for these hipster social media things. Yeah.
Yes, right.
But Martin, maybe you want to comment on that too.
I use it every day, yeah.
Excellent. Full disclosure, Martin is 4 years younger than I am. At least this is what he says.
Right. Well, I will say it was a bit abrupt. But it's also great because I got 5 hours a week of my life back. And I had done this for 13 years, so that 13 years is plenty. You know, I established my reputation. I'm always going to be known now for Floss Weekly, as well as being known for Pearl. And still trying to be known better for Dart and Flutter, you know. So, yeah.
Wild question, Randall. Are there any new plans for new podcasts on the horizon for you?
You know, it was so much work doing a podcast. I don't know. I've been invited. Yeah. I've been invited. Yeah.
Sorry.
I've been invited to join a network. So we'll see how much, whether I'm actually going to take up something on that. Let's see.
As in a paid engagement this time, or?
You know, that's the interesting thing. When I would read ads, some of the revenue from the ads would come back to me. So it wasn't like this is a totally unpaid gig.
Okay. I thought it was all going to Twitter. Sorry, to Twit, rather. Not Twitter, but Twit.
Yeah. Well, maybe going to Twitter, too. We don't know. It wasn't a lot of money. I mean, obviously, they got to keep most of it because they got to have production costs taken care of. But, it's not like I said, it's not like a lot of money, but it was, insignificant.
I mean, Leo runs a commercial enterprise, as in Twit is a company. So,
right.
And of course, there are production costs and all the rest of it.
Right. Right.
Okay. By the way, you probably can recall the episode. There was an episode with regards to a Linux Outlaw special about a year or one and a half ago. And this podcast, full disclosure, is called Linux In-Laws for a reason.
Right.
I don't know how much you're familiar with the original Linux Outlaws format as done by Fab and Dan. But
I listed a few of them.
Okay, but we aim to continue the legacy here. Right. Never mind Dan having turned to different subjects, Fab doing very different things these days. I'm just wondering how you came across them initially, because that kind of legacy episode, I reckon, wasn't the first one where they were on your podcast.
I think it was the overlap of Dan.
Okay. Because you knew Dan way back. Okay.
Dan was working with me as part of the rotating panel of co-hosts. And then I was on a couple of their shows, I think. At least one. I remember at least one. And then we decided that we would do sort of a celebration of Linux Outlaws as one of the podcasts on Floss Weekly.
Indeed. And just wondering, that goes back to one of the original questions I had. How did you recruit the co-hosts?
Friends and friends of friends.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, like Aaron had his own podcast. Dan, of course, had his own podcast. Simon was, highly respected in the open source community.
I think he still is in certain quarters.
Sorry, what?
I think he still is in certain quarters.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, clearly.
Being the head of the OSI and stuff.
Yeah, well, and when I recruited him, it used to be Sun, now Oracle, open source advocate. And so that was important to me to be able to pull that together.
I mean, he certainly added a certain color to the whole show, given his outspoken nature. Is that the word I'm looking for? Being the OSI, I think he used to be a chairman, right? Or he still is? I don't know.
He was something. I don't remember all the titles he's had. Mm. It's just been too many. But the thing is that he's clearly was against open core and all that stuff. So it's like open core, no, you know, like that. And so why didn't you just open source the whole thing? You know, why do you have you know, a model that doesn't allow for a community? You know, he was really good at asking all those questions. And so it's funny is on the times when he wasn't there, when I had questions about, you know, why they're not doing those things, we had a back chat so we could chat back and forth with the hosts and the production people. And I would always say, I'm about to channel Simon.
Very, very funny.
I played bad cop for a little while, and then, you know, once I played bad cop, it was like, okay, yeah.
I mean, it certainly added a certain flavor to the whole thing. And I think from a communist perspective, and I reckon I speak for a lot of people in the open source movement, never mind free and open source or software movement, you need that sort of different perspective. And certainly given the fact that the OSI is one of the most important community representations in this area, it does make a lot of sense to have something like Simon on that podcast.
Right.
In the past, but also going forward.
Yeah, the problem was that he wasn't very technical. He was much more philosophical than technical.
Absolutely. Yes.
And so, you know, if I needed a technical backup, then, you know, I had to have one of the other guys on to be able to do that. But, you know, like I said, he was on enough times that I could tell exactly where he was going to go, you know, and also that I could channeling Simon, later.
Did you have any more people? Sorry,
go ahead, Martin.
Did you have any more people like that you could channel on demand?
Not really. Okay. You know, it's very, very sad that we had, you know, Guillermo pass away while we were doing the show, because he worked well with his Maker projects. And of course, Aaron was really good at that. So,
well, he continues the legacy, you know, with his Makerspace and so forth.
Right, exactly.
Fun fact, did you know actually that I helped to review his book?
Oh, good. He was supposed to send me a copy, and he didn't. So.
I just pester him. That's why this is what worked for me. After Chris's
effort. Oh, okay.
Sorry, Anne, you come. If you're listening, full marks. Your book is great.
Yes, nice. Yep.
Okay. Okay, Randall. Can we talk a little bit about ZipRecruiter and what happened afterwards, or you want to give that a miss? We can cut this out too.
No, it's fine. Well, like everybody that was affected by COVID, the ZipRecruiter laid off almost, I think, 800 contractors and furloughed about 150 employees. And so
it wasn't
me. it was the whole trying to, you know, pull in all the expenses so that if you had to ride out the storm, you could do that. And other companies did that too. I'm on a couple of mailing lists that talked about how you know, we just laid off, we just slewed left and right, because they had to. They needed to pull in expenses to make sure that they could survive this rough time.
But you found something new.
Oh yeah, yeah. I'm working for IntelliSurvey right now, which is it's a company based in Orange County, California. So once again, I'm working for a Southern California company.
So you're still commuting in that case?
Well, no, I'm not on site at all. I'm just working completely remote. Nobody's working on site these days. Nobody.
Yeah, it's the same here, obviously. But,
yeah.
Oh, come, Martin, your turn. Just to stop me talking for my, just to stop me talking all the time.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, so is that your? I mean, do you do these gigs on a short term basis, or do you have any particular kind of? I mean, yeah.
Well, this one looks like it's possibly longer, so we'll see. I worked at ZipRecruiter for 4.5 years, and I worked at the company before that for a year, and I worked at the company before that for 2.5 years. So, I mean, I like to have as long term as I can, because then I don't have to hunt down, you know, more work.
No, that's fair. But you're not pursuing any particular kind of, direction with these gigs. You just, it's something that looks vaguely interesting or keeps you, it's like, you know, take Chris Ryer, as long as it's open source related, he'll work for them. But for yourself, it's more of a, bring the money in kind of scenario.
Well, yeah, I'm treating time for money, you know, and yeah.
like we all do.
Yes, exactly. I gotta pay the bills.
We all do, right? Simple as that.
Right. Right. Exactly.
Yes. As soon as the word got out that we are doing an interview with you today, people start sending in money to get the truth about the Mexican situation. Jokes aside, what's the story with your Mexican apartment and the fridge and the fridge magnets?
Well, I won't be there for a while because I can't renew my passport. The U.S. is not renewing passports right now, so I'm kind of screwed. And so I can't go there. Not that I could, if I had a passport, could I go there? Because they also shut down the border, so I can't get there at all. Actually, my passport's good to the end of June, but like I said, I'm not really counting on them opening the border before then.
Might be a bit tricky getting back as well.
And the apartment is a timeshare, or do you own the place?
I'm on a lease.
Okay.
So,
because you seem to have split your time between Oregon as well as Mexico, right?
Right. Yeah, I prefer Mexico because an Uber to get to the nearest restaurant is probably $12. There, an Uber to get even to downtown central Tijuana is $3. So everything is much cheaper. Yes, okay. Everything is much cheaper. Plus, just right outside, I live in the residential district, but it's about a block and a half to 9 restaurants, all in a row. And so it's walking distance. I mean, and it's safe walking distance because it's right by a hospital, you know, so people aren't going to mess with you.
Like your Mexican food as well, then?
Well, you know, what's funny is they have like an amazing variety of food. It's not just Mexican food, but I do like Mexican food, so no big deal. And I like spicy stuff. I like spicy stuff, so it's kind of cool. It's cool. You know, what's funny is I went to Brazil a few times and I asked about, you know, is your food spicy? And they go, no, they don't like spicy food in Brazil, which I thought was weird because it's a Latin American country, you know. Well, it's a Latin country. Well, so it's a little weird.
That's the Portuguese for you, right? So Spain is a neighbor, but hey, you can't have it all. Right. Okay, one last question before we have to wrap this up. The obsession with cruises.
What do you mean, obsession?
For an average person, you seemed to go on cruises quite a lot.
Yeah, I've been on 82 in the last 15 years.
This is what I call the obsession, yes. Sorry, do you care to elaborate or? Sorry,
well,
no offense, no, but.
So, what happened was I was asked to be the first speaker on the first cruise, which was a Pearl cruise.
I see.
And there were 10 speakers, and I was one of them, but I was the first one asked. And there was about 200 people that were attending the classes. And it went out of Vancouver, B.C. Vancouver, B.C. up to Juneau and back, basically. And I thought I wouldn't like cruising because I kept thinking shuffleboard and all those other crappy things, buffets. Right. But I liked it so much, I said to Neil Bauman, Captain Neil, we call him, can I go on the second cruise? And he says, sure. Can you talk about something about Java? Because that's what the cruise is about. And I said,
you're serious?
I can do Java regular expressions because that's the same as Perl regular expressions. And so I basically taught a class on Java regular expressions. And then I liked that so much that I just said, I'll go on the next one. On a lot of them, I was a speaker, at least in the early days. But after that, the it was like not my subject matter. So I couldn't do anything. So I ended up, the deal with Captain Neil was for the ones I'm speaking on, I would get my room for free. On the ones that I was just attending, I would get the room at wholesale. So that's nice. That still wasn't bad. It was still like a 30% discount. So,
nice.
So it worked out nice. But thanks to that, I've been to, let's see, did I say 82 cruises or 82?
You did,
cruises?
Yes.
You did, yeah.
82 cruises.
Okay, I think, well, so somewhere in there, I think it's 62 countries. So somewhere in there, I think I might have got those backwards. I think it might be 62 and 82 countries. But I know I've been like all over the world and been to lots of places I wouldn't have ever gotten to because of these cruises. So I'm very happy.
Yeah, go ahead.
It's too bad. It's too bad that, you know, I don't think the cruise industry is going to recover.
Hmm. Interesting.
It's just they're dry docking some of their ships. They're, you know, because nobody wants to be on, a metal box in the ocean with a lot of other people these days. So it's a little crazy.
Okay. Final three questions. There's a long standing tradition in our numerous seasons, never mind episodes of these seasons, to do a POX, as in a pick of the week. So anything that comes to mind that you have come across recently or earlier that you found interesting, worth mentioning, worth remembering. That's the whole idea behind the POX, yes. And of course, right. There's also an anti-POX, as in a reverse POX.
You know, nothing's coming to mind. It's not the way I think. So okay. I'm trying to remember everything I've seen this week, even in the last 4 weeks. I'm not finding anything. So okay. I don't know.
Yeah, and final two questions. This goes back to a long-standing tradition that I picked up from someplace, or that we picked up from someplace else. Your favorite compiler-based programming language, as in a program language that takes a piece of source code and translates it to machine code rather than interpreting programming language. So Dart wouldn't qualify.
They now have Dart standalone, so it does compile down. So yes, you could say it's the Dart standalone.
You see, other podcasts asked about favorite editors, but we're gonna give that a miss. What's your favorite typesetting system, if you have one?
Well, I haven't used one in a while. I did write a macro package for nroftrof that was eventually used to essentially create programming Perl.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. Nice. And what's funny is it went full circle. I wrote this I was at Tektronix, which was the biggest employer in Oregon for a while. And one of the guys that worked for me took a copy of it with him and took it and eventually Tim O'Reilly Tim O'Reilly and Steve used that as their way of writing all the X books, so all the X11 books.
You serious?
Those were all written using my macros. Okay, so when we signed up for programming Perl, the editor sent these macros to me and said, and I looked in the source code. And there's my comments. So it's wow. My code. It was absolutely my code. And the next day, the editor for Programming Perl said, "Are you going to have any trouble understanding these macros?" And I said, "I wrote them. I wrote them.
You didn't make the comments.
I don't have any problems. Yeah, I don't think I'm going to have any problem understanding this." And so he says, no, we wrote this in-house. And I go, "No, you didn't." I see my comments.
Put your name in the comments.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, yes, nroft tRoft.
Interesting. Okay, Randall, we have to wrap this up. Thank you very much for being on this episode. Much appreciated.
Well, thanks for having me.
And anytime. And we're looking forward to having you back at some stage. Yep. And thanks again for joining this podcast, and talk to you soon. Take care.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Martin, what do you make of the interview?
Oh, I think it was a very great insight into Floss Weekly, which is one of your favorite podcasts. And I think as we discussed recently, there's going to be some changes, right, to Floss.
You see this, yeah.
In terms of its popularity and...
You'll see, yeah.
The way things are run.
You'll see this already coming up. The format is changing. Not too sure how many listeners have observed this transition from Randall to somebody called Doc Searles. The format is changing in addition to the content. He still does do the co-hosts, but in contrast to Randall, he doesn't give an overview of the projects on any given week anymore, but rather it's now about topics. So about a week ago, he had some... old fart is not politically correct. So some elderly person talking.
A grumpy old person?
No, some older, elderly person talking about ham radio and how this whole internet thing came about. Right. My impression is, and I'm more than happy to put some money on this, or maybe we can just basically put this...
Quite a beer?
Unfortunately, I'm bound by an internal NDA, so I can't really talk about the specifics of this remark. Okay, people, sorry. Martin is referring to a previous incident that we unfortunately cannot discuss in the show. I'm more than happy to put some money on this, but I reckon before long, Twit TV will have a problem with regards to dropping listenerships for Floss Weekly, unless Leo, who's the guy behind Twit, can mobilize OAPs like us, like Martin and myself. OAPs are standing, of course, for old age pensioners, as in people who are really old and have been around when ham radio was still the rage.
And obviously have a pension. Which we don't. Yes.
Okay. Any other take on this, Martin?
No, it was good. I liked the interview because obviously, as we are both fairly new to podcasting, it was a good insight into how they started and how they got people on the show and how it went from there. So,
I mean, I said it on the interview, but Randall and I started listening, I think, in 2013, 2014, something like this, or maybe as early as 2012. Yeah. Funny enough, that was also the time when Redis Labs was founded, I think. Anyway, doesn't matter. That show has been pivotal, pun intended. Yes, Martin used to work for Pivotal. If anybody's wondering about this remark, anyway, it doesn't matter.
So did Peter Nordhaus.
Yes, indeed. And
that was VMware.
Salvatore worked for this too, but not to worry about this.
He did.
Yes, Randall was actually one of the driving forces behind my interest in community communication, let's put it this way. And I reckon it's fair to say, without Randall, there wouldn't be a Linux In-Laws. You'll see this every now and then, because we do bring on guests, although we do not do this on a weekly basis. but this whole format and the projects that we cover and the guests we bring on certainly reflects the kind of early days of Floss Weekly. So to say that Floss Weekly has been an inspiration for Linux In-Laws is probably just an understatement. And it's really sad to see Randall going from this show, because I reckon that... within a certain period of time, the listenership will decrease. And that's rather unfortunate, because I consider, never mind what other people say, the Floss Weekly, which was then still run by Randall Schwartz, as one of the cornerstones of community coverage in terms of communication, giving the projects that are worth covering an outlet, if you will, to spread the word. Go ahead, Martin. There is
alternative podcast now.
There is. There's something called Linux In-Laws, of course. Blatant self-promotion ending tag. Okay. No, jokes aside. It was. I mean, why did I start to listen to Floss Weekly? Straightforward. I was still commuting to work then, which is not the case anymore, because I just work from home these days. But during the commute, these hour-long episodes gave me an overview of happening projects in the community. You had the project people on the show asking questions. You had live participations from the audience. Yeah. So it was then, I think, an IRC channel or some chat room on Twit.tv. Where you could actually ask live questions, and I think this is still on with the new formula, but I'm not too sure. But that was always an opportunity to participate in the live show, but even you, if you would listen to a recording like I did most of the times during my commute, it would give you within these 50 minutes, 60 minutes, just a compact overview of what that project was all about. And when I finally got home, back home on that day, if the project deemed to be interesting enough, I simply checked it out. I used Floss Weekly, full disclosure, on quite a few occasions myself to promote more or less events, not projects. So, for example, the Linux user group that I'm still chairing does something called the Mouse Door Opener Day. It's essentially a very Mouse Door Opener project. You'll find the link. Yeah, you'll find the link in the show notes. Okay. The show with the mouse is a long-standing kid entertainment format that has been going on for the last 45, 50 years, something like this in Germany. And about, I think, 7 or 8 years ago, they introduced something called the Mouse Door Opener Day, where kids could go places through doors that otherwise would be closed. Meaning that the LUG, the Linux User Group that I'm chairing, or co-chairing rather, has been participating in these Mouse Door Opener Days organized by the broadcaster for the last 3 years, 4 years, something like this. I mean, need to say there won't be a Mouse Door Opener Day this year for obvious reasons, but for the last 4 years, actually, we have been doing this, introducing kids between the age of 6 and 12 during the course of a full day to open source. So the way we did it, basically, we brought them in. We had about four projects or four software packages that we used, like LibreOffice, so kids could do their own their first presentation with LibreOffice. And then Scratch, where you would simply use a GUI to program instead of writing code, and this, and then making music with Linux and so forth. The idea was basically, in contrast to schools, where Microsoft still used that as a training ground for kids, to introduce them, at least here in Germany,
I think that's changed.
To introduce them to Excel, to Word, and to PowerPoint, to show them an open source alternative. And the kids normally had the opportunity to present their work, and did so, by the way. I can still remember the first Mouse Door Opener Day when we did this. A six-year-old girl presented one slide made done with Impress in front of an audience of about 40 people. First presentation forever. The mother was crying, but she still made an appearance. I mean, this is just amazing. And we have been doing this, as I said, for the last 4 years. And this is... and so I went public with this on Floss Weekly. In the following year, at least two people that came to our Mouse Door Opener Day said, now look, we heard about this, not just on the TV show, but also on Floss Weekly. And I found this quite amazing.
Which TV show?
The show with the mouse, because they normally teaser that Mouse Door Opener Day.
Okay, sorry. There is also a TV show with mice.
Yes, that was the show that has been going on for the last 40 plus years.
In Germany.
Yes.
In Germany.
Okay. It's all getting very confusing, Martin, I know.
That can explain.
Okay, first there was a TV show, and then about 30 plus years into the show, they introduced this Mouse Door Opener Day. It takes place on the 3rd of October, normally in the year. And the idea is to open doors that are normally closed for parents and children alike. So firefighters open their doors, library open their doors. What else? There's a various cooking school that blatantly uses this in Frankfurt, that blatantly uses this as a PR gag or promotion to get more parents into their cooking classes. So anything goes, and the LUG here in Frankfurt decided to participate in this Mouse Door in this Mouse Door Opener Day, as I said, about 4 years ago.
Cool. Sounds great.
So, yes, and I promoted this on Floss Weekly, and the year after that, we got feedback. Enough with the self promotion. Let's get on to the feedback. An anonymous listener posted on Hacker Public Radio, by the way, where we hosted the show for the time being, and should that change, you'll be the first to know, as in we're gonna announce it here on the show. Anonymous listener posted a comment on the 2nd of July about a previous episode and said that the discussion about licenses and contribution agreements was interesting and informative. For example, I really like the way Fred explained how LGPL works in the context of projects like Big Blue Button and how it compares to AGPL. Thanks for the show. Thank you, anonymous listener.
This was episode 7?
Martin is the bean counter of the two of us. So he keeps track about subjects, topics, interviews, and guests. I'm more on the creative...
Well, we also have a...
Yes, I'm more on the creative side. For example, I read comments. That's my job.
Excellent.
So yes, that was of course the episode on the Big Blue Button. And there was another comment posted on that particular day by Ahuka, who is of course a frequent contributor to Hacker Public Radio, in case people are missing this. And he said, good interview, I really enjoyed the interview, good solid information about an open source project. And Ahuka, and also to you, anonymous listener, thank you for your feedback. We appreciate it. Okay, people, the next episode will be on a teaser. Two old farts and their arrival at communism. You want to elaborate, Martin?
So, next episode will be done by our great friends and colleagues, David and Thomas, who are both grumpy and old and like to talk about communism being from Eastern Germany. And
Martin
so
got this wrong. Okay. Blatant not self-promotion. Check it out. It's on SoundCloud. There's a new podcast called Two Grumpy Old Coders. Both two Eastern Germans talking about Microsoft and Redis. Now, if this is up your alley, check it out. I'll put the link into the show notes just in case. Martin is toying with the idea of bringing them on as guests. I'm not so confident or I'm not so sure about this. Let's see.
I think we were doing a sketch, right?
Let's see.
Calls for a sketch.
Yeah. David and Thomas, if you're listening to this, feel free to get in touch so we don't have to do a sketch.
I'm sure they were looking forward to the sketch.
Okay. Anything else before we close this? Of course, the teaser, yes. No, the next... Yes.
The next show
will be about Martin and myself talking how we got not to just here, but also to the concept of open source. So Martin will spill the beans how he ended up at what's the name of that new company, Martin? You're working for Blit something, right? Blitlit or something? Blitglit?
Not yet. No. Give me
okay. Which is of course a closed source company. I hope Martin can live with the pain.
It's an open core company.
Okay, like so I'm still working for...
Well, open core, maybe open peripheral.
If you can, Martin, if you can live with the pain, that's okay, no worries. Where I continue to work for an open core company called Redis Labs, full disclosure. But this show won't be about Martin's new employer, nor it will be about Redis Labs, but rather it will be at...
Yes,
no marketing involved in contrast to the grumpy two old coders. I might add. It will be essentially a show about reminiscing about the past and how we got into open source and our road to these these concepts and communism and stuff. So if you're interested in learning, hearing about how some old farts got into open source way back, check out, what is it, season 1, episode 13, right?
13.
This is 12, so upcoming one is...
Randall 12, yes.
Yes, Mr. Vista, excellent. And, of course, you'll find us on Hacker Public Radio. Feel free, we are always looking for feedback, feel free to get in touch, either by a comment on Hacker Public Radio itself, or preferred, send feedback to feedback@linuxinlaws.eu. And indeed, final closing remark. Going forward, you may find us on Google Podcasts if I got this right over the weekend. Stay tuned. This episode is proudly powered by the Grumpy Old Coders. Why leave your business-critical projects to the young hipsters with their fancy, loosely coupled programming languages like JavaScript and Python, never mind that fad called NoSQL databases, which will be history in a fortnight when you can count on rock-solid professional experience dating back decades rather than weeks. With the combined expertise span of touching nearly a century, we can assure you that the app stack driving your collective will not only survive the next few decades, but does so in an optimized fashion. Using our patented Windows on Rust technology, essentially a Windows emulation running on Big Iron, we can crunch your SQL Server batch runs from months or weeks down to days, giving you a near real-time insight into how your business is doing, so that you can send that all-important fax to the underperforming branch tomorrow rather than next week. The Grumpy Old Coders are proud to support Linux Inlaws, the up-and-coming open-source podcast. We are all communists at heart, comrades. This podcast is licensed under the latest version of the Creative Commons license, type attribution share alike. Credits for the intro music go to Blue Sea Roosters for their song Salute Margaret, to Twin Flames for their piece called The Flow, used for the segment intros, and finally to Celestial Ground for their song Sweet Justice, used by the Dark Side. You find these and other ditties licensed under CC at Jamendo, a website dedicated to liberate the music industry from choking copyright legislation and other crap concepts. So we can bitch about Mint or Ubuntu or both.
And Snaps and
audio. Yes, indeed, we can. Randall, hi.
Hi.
Good to have you back.
Hi again. Yeah.
Now, Randall, don't be disappointed. We don't do video normally. So you're more than happy to turn your video on. But
I got to show you my kick-ass camera.
That's okay. That's okay, Randall. But as I said, so, you won't see any video stream. You won't see any video of us. Because I'm naked and Martin is even wearing a lipstick, so that's okay.
Should we resume?
Yes. Martin is undecided.
So you want to do feedback next, yes?
I want to do feedback and the outro and then we're almost finished.
Okay.
Which comes in handy because it's 20 to 8.
Yes, good timing.
Cut. So, Martin, what do you make of...
What do you mean, cut? Why are you cutting again?
And cut because the interview's finished.
Stop cutting, man.
Oh, fuck. And...
It's not cut, it's resume. Resume.
/resume.
We have...
Yes, we do.
Yes, episode... Number 8.
Yes. You want to read this out?
The review of the review. Yeah, sure.
I thought we did this already. But so to do this again.
What do you mean?
The review of the review.
How can we do this? How can we do this already if we just done the big blue button comment? Because that was before.
Okay.
8. Yes. Big blue button was 7. Gloria was 8.
So why don't you read it out then?
Sure. So. Comment by Claudio N. Also a contributor to HBR.
I wonder who that is.
Could be anybody, right? Anyway, he says, all according to plan, smiley face. You really thought I would have done my research? I wouldn't have done my research before recording. This is the next step on. Yes, we have done this.
Yes, Martin, we did.
What? No. Why are we doing a feedback on 7 then?
Because we didn't do the feedback on 7 yet.
Why didn't we do the feedback on 7?
We didn't do it. It has to do with our production schedule, yes.
Scheduling.
Just blame No. Who's doing that these days? It's not Anya anymore. It's
post production department. No.
Peter. No. Hang on. It's the two grumpy old coders. Yes. David and Thomas. David, Thomas, please do a better job next day. Next time around, please do, because as you see, this really fucks up our schedule.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Episode 9, then.
Okay,
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HBR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club and is part of the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 license.